Welcome to the Out of the Woods podcast, the top five headlines threat hunters need to be thinking of this week.
Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Lee Arcanal.
Thanks for joining us, everyone.
And this weekly segment features the top five stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top five threat hunting headlines for the week of March 11th, 2024. So I was going to start with an article I picked up on from Checkpoint, you know, the research team, and it's titled Magnet Golem Targets Publicly Facing Servers Using One-Day Vulnerabilities. And basically, it's about a group or an actor. They've dubbed the Magnet Goblin, but it's financially motivated, so it's more like that criminal actor. And it just talks about the speed at which they quickly adopt all those day-old vulnerabilities when they get released or POCs show up. And some of the evidence showed, for example, like the Avanti Connect VPN, Magento, Qlink Sense, and they may have used like Apache ActiveMQ vulnerabilities of near recent. And usually once they exploit a target there using like the Nurbian Rat or Linux variant of that, Warp Wire, which is kind of a JavaScript cred stealer, and then Ligolo, which is more of an open source tumbling tool. It's written in Go. And they also, if they get persistence within an environment, they've historically been seen using like Screen Connect and AnyConnect, some of those remote management tools. We see a lot of criminal, you know, a lot of ransomware associated to groups using those tools as well. But one of the things that, you know, I kind of took away from this, you know, they kind of walk through kind of some of the different ransomware, or not ransomware, some of the different malware, C2 type of structures and controls, and some of the IPs and URLs and things. So there's some interesting technical IOCs you can look at. But one of the things they called out, and I kind of pivoted away from the article, was a lot of the long-standing connections from these types of appliances. So we're talking about, you know, web-facing servers, which could either be appliances or some sort of service that you're kind of hosting that needs to be web-facing. Well, a lot of times when these things get exploited, it's really good to look for, I would say, two major things. One is that long-standing connections, because a lot of times when you have services that, you know, usually is kind of more of a ping-pong effect as far as, you know, you fetch something, you drop something, you get something. But when someone gains access and they create a shell-type access, you'll see things that usually are longer connections than the same type of activity to the same services and ports that you normally don't see. So it should be an outlier as far as length goes. There was that. And then the other thing I typically like to look for, depending on the kind of vulnerabilities you may see on those types of services, is if there's remote code execution. You know, a lot of times you'll see the post-exploitation behavior, where if the, you know, service is, you know, your app exe in this specific directory, maybe it's like Apache directory, for instance, then those, that main key process or your app exe process, if you're on a Windows type machine, is then the parent of a lot of common scripting type executions, you know, PowerShell, the CMD terminal, for command prompts, WScript, and MSHTA, like those types of executions that are able to run other code. It's usually a good chain to look for when you're looking for post-exploitation. So that's kind of what I really wanted to kind of open up here is, you know, it's really, you can see how actors can quickly adopt vulnerabilities, especially when they're financially motivated, because they really just want to get in and their objective is very short and sweet. But staying consistent with looking for those long-term connections, as well as those post-exploitation executions can go a long way, especially when you don't have all the information to respond directly to the specific vulnerabilities that may have been revealed. So that's really all I have. What are your thoughts on the topic?
So from a technical standpoint, I think you already hit it. There's that, as I was going through reading this, there's a lot of living off the land binary or living off the land activity after an initial access, right? After that, they gain access through or once they exploit the vulnerability, there's going to be that follow-on action. Now, while that follow-on action won't always point back to exactly where you got compromised from or what vulnerability was exploited, it may at least tell you that something else is going on, that there's something going on in your environment that is definitely tied to something else. The weird thing is, I think instead of going threat hunting on this article, I think it is, and you know, I'm probably going to ask some questions and ramble a bit here, but you said that you're financially motivated. Now, normally this is a title or a description tied to APT groups, right? They're financially motivated or they're going for espionage or whatever the case may be. The fact that whenever a proof of concept or a POC is published, even if it is a single day afterwards, that they are getting access, but where they're finding devices that are vulnerable and exploiting them that quickly, I feel like that sets the bar for legitimate organizations. I know not all organizations are at that level. I know small to medium businesses may have one cybersecurity person. But whenever it does come to larger organizations, I feel like, and this could be a complete crap take, but if the adversaries can do this and look for vulnerable devices, probably using Shodan or open source tools, across the world and then exploiting them successfully, why can't we as organizations keep our hardware or our software, our inventory up to date, be aware that we have that in our environment, and be able to, if possible, and I'm not saying it's always possible, because if a proof of concept comes out and there's no patch or no fix currently, then there's always the option to increase logging, increase monitoring, do something around those devices, right? That is outside the norm and at like an elevated pace or process. The fact that they can turn around and exploit them that quickly kind of tells us that as an organization, as a corporate company who is also financially motivated to stay in business, why would we not be able to do the same thing? I mean, I know that's, I hope it's not like I'm coming off as a jerk or anything, but it just seems like if they can do it, why can't we? Why can't the legitimate organizations get that motivation to find the vulnerabilities inside their own environment and do something about it as quickly as the adversaries can?
I think you bring up a good point, and I'm trying to think of, so I know a lot of groups that manage vulnerabilities, they want to run through their process. And I think that's a good thing, right? Because they can like make sure to check all the boxes that they're fixing things the right way and they're thinking about things the right way. But I don't know if a lot of organizations have the best process when it comes to like, hey, we need to get an express lane for this because a POC just got published that we're aware of. You know, other than like blindly patching, you know, that may cause impacts, you know, depending on what it is. So I think that's something that a lot of people should consider is it's okay to have a mature process that maybe take a little bit of time, but knowing that there are some vulnerabilities that can get turned around really quick, especially, you know, when you see the POC code, like looking for POC code is an important part of the process, but when you know there's, it's already being exploited or there's POC code out there, there needs, you know, it's always good to have that. Well, how do we hit that switch where we don't need 99% of approvals to go forward with this? We have the right people looking at the right things to make the right fixes, when it's go time. I think, you know, that's a reasonable expectation to at least have a process like that.
Absolutely. It's like a, almost like an instant response for patches and vulnerabilities. So it's not just, oh, we're scanning here. You know, it's like, oh, we have to do something about this. And I forget which incident response company is it Mandiant or is it one of those big names that provides like different levels of, no, it was Olaf Hartong, I think. I was just looking at, because one of the posts recently by Cyborg was about Sysmon and looking at Olaf Hartong. His Sysmon config. There were like different levels of monitoring, right? So like if you're instant response mode, put this configuration file. If it's daily grind, you know, use this one and so on. I just feel like that should be something that should be applied to this exact situation, right? A proof of concept comes out for a device that is yours and you know it's vulnerable, get that going so you can, just in case you can't patch it right away.
I mean, it's a good point. It's a good thing for people to be thinking about. But that was kind of the reason why I thought it was a cool article, was not so much how did Magna Goblin really behave and act, but more about their processes to turn things around so quickly. So, you know, that changes our expectations sometimes.
Yeah.
Because I've seen, and this, you know, this really goes toward public facing things, right? And maybe that's really what we're talking about, is maybe you don't need a shortcut key for that, for dispatching in general, but when things are public facing, you should have something that's relatively fast in general. But yeah, that's all I got. What did you find?
So my first article is from, actually it's like a group of articles, but one's actually quite old, but these articles cover some user account control abuse that the same technique that has been around for quite some time. The article published by Almond Offsec Security was first published in 2017 and then updated in 2019, and then the Cisco Talos threat intel team witnessed the Phobos ransomware abusing the same particular technique. Now, this technique involved, I believe the registry key value was inproc server, so INPROC server 32, that you can add into the registry keys in the the CLS ID location. So software class to CLS ID, and then you modify the registry key from there. So once you have that the registry key created and modified, what you can do with it is you can point that registry key to whatever payload you want on the local machine. Now, you also have to modify some environment variables as well. But if you can do this successfully, you can now run that DLL at an elevated with elevated privileges. Now, they called out that if you try to modify the local machine registry key hive, so HKLM, if you're trying to modify those, you need elevated privileges already. But if you don't have those, if you modify the current user or the HKCU registry key, it can be modified without, and it says it does not require elevation. So knowing this, there's also the hive of HKCR, which is a combination, or it's a combined view of those two, HKLM and HKCU registry hives. So I know that I kind of just threw that out there. Might have made a mess. But with HKCU, you don't need elevated privileges. HKLM does. But both of those create the HKCR registry hive view. So if you modify the HKCU, it will eventually make its way into the HKCR registry hive. allowing the adversary to modify the register key to run something, if it exists on the machine and whatever file they're targeting, at an elevated privilege. Why am I talking about a 2019 attack or technique? One, because it still works today. In November of 2023, the Cisco Talos group published an article titled "A Deep Dive into Phobos Ransomware, Recently Deployed by 8Base Group." They noticed that this UAC bypass technique was still being used and was still working. They actually linked to the article that Amon wrote. But they said that this is still working and it's still being abused by the adversary. So that 2017 article, 2019 article is still relevant, which, first of all, UAC bypass or user account control bypass has always been a hot topic. It's always been something that really it kind of bothers me. Because one of the things that this has been brought up to Microsoft multiple times, and they always say that it is not a security boundary, so it's not something that they're going to change or modify. I'm guessing because of the way that it works, the intricacy of using COM objects and so on, there's a lot more to it than they would have to change. Granted, it still makes things vulnerable. And we actually have, I think, we have a lot of UAC bypass hunt packages that exist. But this is one of the few ones that I've seen that is currently being abused and being abused, or not just this technique being abused, but Phobos ransomware being an emerging threat. We just recently released a hunt package or hunt package collection searching for these for tactics, techniques associated with the Phobos ransomware that include, persistence mechanisms that it uses, like modifying the auto start or auto run locations in Windows, whether that be like the auto run registry key or, the Microsoft Windows startup location, or, deleting system catalog, like when the adversary goes through and deletes everything behind. This is now a big thing. So that thing that like Amon Security warned us about back in 2017 and 2019, it's now kind of just making its way and being like, hey, you know what? We warned you. Now it's actively being exploited in the past. So now hopefully maybe this will, bring more of a urgency to the idea of UAC. If you're hunting for this, look for registry keys being modified, specifically with CLS IDs attached to them. Look for suspicious processes coming from compmanager.msc or computermanagement.msc and sometimes mmc.exe as well. But it's just, I'm going to start with UAC because what's Family Guy's that grinds my gears? I'm gonna go to you. What were your thoughts?
So yeah, I thought it was interesting because you're dealing with COM objects. It seems like a lot here because you got the mproc server 32, and for those that aren't too familiar with COM objects, it's kind of a way for your system to make available DLLs for specific functionality on the machine. So there's some things that you may use more often, and there's some things you may not really use at all, as far as depending on what you're doing on your computer and what applications you're running. But the one thing you noted when it comes to the current user hive versus the local machine hive and registry, the reason why it's such an interesting vector, because obviously you can manipulate your own hive, your current user hive. But there's a precedence. So for instance, like you mentioned, if I change my COM service data for the current user, it actually overwrites or takes precedence over the system level COM information. And so historically, attackers will sometimes figure out, well, what services or what libraries that exist on that computer that if they break, they don't actually like break the functionality of the computer. Like they won't blue screen the computer. They won't break anything completely obvious. And they can actually take over those COM objects by doing the current user updates. And now they can run their code instead, and maybe some search functionality and, you know, Explorer might not work, right? So that's kind of like what's interesting about the vector in general is just knowing enough about how the system works, you can manipulate it in a many different ways. So there's that piece that's interesting. But the other piece is interesting, especially the article that you brought up, was they showed that not only could you load the DLL you want with the, you know, your COM object being loaded, but you can actually load one that is potentially shared over the network. So if there is, say, an SMB file share that is accessible to you, you can remotely load your malicious DLL by using this technique as well, which is really interesting to make that as exposed and available. You know, you wouldn't expect that, but we're seeing a lot more of that, where there's a lot of Windows components that will pull remote things in as long as you're using the right protocols to discover them and make them accessible. So that kind of becomes a scary vector that really shouldn't be exposed to begin with, but because of the remote work and things like that, I think are more exposed than they have been in the past. So that's interesting. And a lot of the things I like to look for when it comes to COM object manipulation is looking for registry keys in the nproc server. So you're in the same software classes, CLS, ID, you know, structure. But if you see anything with associated with nproc server 32, or I think nproc server, if you're not on a 32-bit, it might just be that. But any values that don't point to system 32 for the DLLs is usually a good indication of, hey, there is some system level functionality that's being called that isn't in a common system level directory. And you might maybe need to include program files and other types of paths that are more system specific. But that's always a good way to kind of look at this approach, I think, in a lot of ways, when you don't really know what you're looking for, but you know what you expect. So, you know, I thought that was a good thing to think about. But you know, this technique has always, you know, fascinated me because I feel like it doesn't get that much attention because it's not something that I would say your average adversary would take advantage of other than, you know, reusing someone else's playbook. But it takes some knowledge of the system to do this effectively and do this long-term effectively very well. So, you know, that's something of interest to me all the time. So yeah, those are my two thoughts. Or few thoughts. I don't know if there are two there, but yeah.
Two really big ones. I really... That was... Wow. So... I feel like it's been brought up way too many times and has been seen too many times to still be a problem. I mean, like, unfortunately, it's not something that we can add into, like, cybersecurity user awareness or like awareness training. It's not like someone's going to get phished or someone could accidentally modify a CLS ID or a UAC bypass registry key and be like, oops, you know, it was phishing email or whatever. I just feel like it's like a technological problem that has been seen so often that something should be done about it.
Well, so to Microsoft's defense, yeah, you know, I kind of think about, yeah, I'm going there. Not as hard as you think, but if you imagine, you know, early adopters of the PC, like you had to have a computer science degree to run computers, right? Like, yeah, the little punch card things. You had to know a code level on the terminal side to be able to type things out to do what you want to do. And then Windows came along and now everyone can use computers. Well, I mean, guess Apple before Windows, right? With some of their stuff. But, you know, Windows came along and it made it the computer accessible to everyone. But I think in doing so, you know, they created this structure of things that need to be available in a certain way so the computer is usable for everyone. But also some of these things they built in also make it very manageable for, you know, an environment or a domain. And if they were to, I think, take away some of this functionality, it'll get back to an environment that's harder to manage, which has its risks as well, or the lack of ease of use for people to use the machines, which is a cost to, you know, productivity and business. So I feel like it's just kind of like unnecessary kind of evil at this point, unless, you know, the whole OS gets redesigned into something that, you know, like Linux that runs, you know, pretty well with graphic user interfaces and things like that, that are just kind of designed a little differently. So yeah, I think that's the problem when you kind of stick with something like this, that architecture of how things are built for ease of use, convenience, manageability, is kind of why this presents itself this way.
Well, not to spoil anything and not to steal your thunder, but based on an article that you'll be talking about later, maybe it will be redesigned.
Yeah, so that's why I was actually going next, because you talked about this one. So yeah, what you're alluding to, right? This was, and you know, I've seen this a lot of places, but just to bring it an easy read to find, you know, the Hackers News had the article, but Microsoft confirms Russian hackers stole source code and some customer secrets. So this is really a continuation of a story that happened the end of last year, kind of the beginning of this year, I believe. But basically, you know, they dub it to Midnight Blizzard or APT29 or Cozy Bear. But they got into like a development environment in Microsoft because they didn't have the same two-factor controls and so forth in the environment. And by having access to that environment, they were able to get access to even more things, right? And now from some of their investigations, they have found that, yes, there was some source code that was exposed and, you know, stolen. And there were some conversations between some Microsoft people and customers that talked kind of about how things work. So when they say secrets, I think that's what they're pertaining to, but they didn't really, you know, expose that. And so this is interesting, you know, in a number of ways. One, you know, it's not surprising that you have Microsoft having a big target for big named adversaries because of where Microsoft sits within the industry of technology. Not only offering resources like a cloud now, but also how to manage an entire domain, because they pretty much are the leader in that space of managing an environment, but also, you know, the resources with Windows, everything's kind of running on Windows, especially on the user side. So a big concern. Now, what this says to me is I do think there's going to be some more novel attacks for how things either get executed or how to get into or bypass certain things within Windows. One of the things I always loved, for instance, was the Defender was kind of built into the kernel. So harder to defeat endpoint tool when it comes to trying to unhook things or approaches like that. Except when someone gets a source code, they might be able to find that way much easier, for instance. So talking about, you know, how Windows was designed and some of the gaps, there may be more gaps that will be found and exploited in the future. That's not necessarily something to like freak out about, but kind of how I like to deal with these types of breaking news things, because this gets management up, you know, well, it makes everybody worry, right? And the concern, I think, is real, but the actions that usually follow some of these things, you know, be on higher alert, you know, man more hours on doing these things. That doesn't solve anything. And that's not, the alert level shouldn't necessarily change, but your approach and priorities maybe will, right? And for instance, you know, I mentioned they talked about Midnight Blizzard, APT29, Cozy Bear. It's really good to pay attention historically how these groups or this group in particular has operated. And I say that because they have behaviors within the malware they use, or with when they get hands on keyboard to certain breaches, to learn from and to look for those type of characteristics. But something else to note, because it is a nation state level, it's also good to pay attention to, you know, this is Russia affiliated, right? Other Russia affiliated APT groups as well, because sometimes if a group gets access and learns how to do certain attacks because of the stolen source code or whatever, that information can be disseminated to other groups for them to be more successful with their mission set. So you kind of run into this whole Russian interest. So it's good to also say, well, what kind of techniques are shared across a lot of these Russian groups? And make sure you're kind of developing and building out and spending time and priorities researching those things if you're concerned about this risk. And that's why I think threat hunting is a good common capability within a security operation, because this is primarily what threat hunters should be spending time on, or activities like this in general. So they kind of have their Swiss Army knife of, oh, who are we dealing with? What kind of things do we know about them, and how do we handle that? And where are our gaps? Where, you know, that kind of thing. It's just a good approach. So that's why I kind of like this article. It wasn't like a groundbreaking, you know, a lot of people want to slam Microsoft on this one too. And yes, I mean, everyone should be held accountable and responsible for their deficiencies. But if you were as big as Microsoft, you'd be getting hit just as hard. And it's not like they don't spend a lot of money and resources on their security stuff. It's just, it's a very complicated problem that no one's solved 100%. So people should take their strides to protect themselves as well.
I will say, this is probably the moment that all those Linux users that have been like promoting Linux over all things probably rejoice, though.
Except for, you know, the funny irony thing there is you can get Linux source code because it's freely available.
Oh, absolutely. So, it's more of like a level playing ground now, right? They're like, oh, well, you know, Microsoft,
right?
Good. Like, we're on the same level now. I'm curious to see if
it's available.
A Russian version of Microsoft come out shortly after this. I'd laugh if it was more secure too. But no, this is rough. And I have a feeling that, you know, questions of how are you going to be monitoring the source code and changes and everything. I think questions like that might come up. It's like, well, I don't know if we have logs for, you know, monitoring the source.
Yeah, it's just going to be new vulnerabilities and exploits, right? Hit the market some way. And the only thing that it kind of sucks is when an APT group gets their hands on something like this, you don't know what they're going to do with it, versus if it's a criminal group that gets out there, somehow things go public fairly quick as far as capabilities and vectors and stuff like that, because they're very proud and loud about things like that.
Right. Whenever you have like almost like the keys of the, or possibly the keys of the kingdom, it kind of changes things. But I thought it was pretty interesting also to see how Microsoft mentioned that they were getting hammered by brute force attempts, and how it like ramped up, and then, you know, they didn't have MFA enabled, which, if you're ever a person that's just out there that got hacked because of MFA or MFA fatigue, you know, you're not alone. Big organizations do it too. And I think Microsoft, and I'm not going to beat Microsoft up for this one because it's not UAC related. But it just goes to show you that the same mistakes that we make as individuals, you know, clicking on a malicious link, getting phished, you know, going out and buying gift cards because we're trying to be helpful. It's not just us. You're not the only one out there saying, man, I'm such a terrible human being. I suck with technology and so on. Big organizations are happening, or is happening to big organizations as well. Unfortunately, the bigger you are, the more you have to lose. And I think this is a case of that. You know, it just so happened to be the source code this time versus business email compromise, or business email compromise where they, you know, ship millions of dollars to a bad guy or got someone to go out and waste a bunch of money and company time as well. But I thought it was kind of a crazy idea that they got some source code, and kind of curious to see where this goes. Really curious to see what new vulnerabilities will come. I hope that somehow are, once again, going back to the one-day vulnerabilities, that hopefully their researchers are, I'm sure they are, but hopefully their researchers are going to beat the bad guys to the punch to find all the vulnerabilities, or most of the vulnerabilities, or at least the key vulnerabilities, and patch them quickly. I guess this is just more of a waiting game.
Yeah, and just like I said, kind of having your ducks in a row, which, you know, I always hate when there's like a call to action in security, because, you know, security people should always be doing their job when it comes to security. And I hate when management leadership always assumes that, like, hey, you guys need to take this seriously. It's like, this is what we do for a living. You don't have to tell us to do our job. This is why you hired us. So, yeah.
Right.
What do you have coming up next?
All right. So, good segue. Microsoft source code being leaked isn't the biggest story. The ransomware industry hit a target that some people are claiming should be categorized as a national emergency, and others are wondering how much substance is left in reserve for their country to survive. That's right. And I hope I'm pronouncing this right. But the Duvel Mordgott Brewery was hit by ransomware. It's a Belgian beer brewery that is known for its strong and fruity golden pale ale that is named after the namesake of the company. But good news out of this is that, and we don't have a lot of technical information. The most we have is that the Stormhouse ransomware group is the one that claimed the attack. They say they have 88 gigs of stolen data, and they're currently holding it. And the ransomware date is March 25th. So if they don't pay by March 25th, they're going to leak all their secrets. People were curious about, you know, is this going to cause price increases and so on? But the media said, or not the, the media team said, don't worry, we have enough beer in stock to compensate this production halt. But good news, also good news, is that the IT security department was able to detect it. And then shut production down. So I know a lot of the articles that we mention are like doom and gloom, but this seems like a case of success. Well, while they did have to shut down, production and possibly hit the amount of resources that they currently have, and then there's always the concern of data being leaked, it seems like they got ahead of this pretty quickly. Hopefully, the Stormhouse ransomware group is, you know, just calling a bluff where they actually don't have a bunch of data, or if the data it does exist, it's not even useful. But it's nice. And I would like to see the technical details. I'm sure it probably won't get published. I'm not sure about the Belgian cybersecurity rules, it's interesting to see a quick win. Or a win from some of these organizations that get hit by ransomware. Granted, it was late in the game, or it sounds like it was late in the game, because they said because the IT department detected ransomware. I'm not sure if that was, it moving through the system, whatever tactics, techniques, procedures it was using, or did it capture a bunch of files being encrypted and extensions being added to the normal file names. So we don't know that, but still, good on that IT department, I guess. Not a technical document, but still a nice win. What were your thoughts?
So, yeah, I thought this was interesting for a couple of reasons. One point is there's no one that's really immune to cyber crime, right? So, regardless of what you do out there, how big or small you are, everyone needs to really understand the risk of connecting things to the internet. And, what does that really mean? And you may not have to really worry about nation states, for instance, but there's always going to be cybercrime. If you're exposed well enough to one, be found, and two, be easily targeted, you can expect something will happen more near term than late term. But, you know, one of the things, you know, kind of brought me back a little bit because, you know, if I worked for, say, this brewery and I was in the cyber, you know, or even the IT, and someone's like, hey, what do you worry about? You know, like what threats do you worry about? I remember always going to briefs early in my career and they'd be like, oh, you should know who your threats are and who's attacking you. And I'm like, well, how do you answer that question? That seems very obscure, you know, like the bad guys or, you know, like how could I say, you know, Russia or China is interested in me or, you know, whatever. And then as I kind of got more mature in my career and I realized, you know, the ones that seemed to know who was attacking them, it wasn't really based off of, hey, they've been attacked in the past and they, you know, they've got the names of the people that were after them because they've been working with law enforcement and just now they know. No, it's really more about understanding the motivations of adversaries. They really kind of give you that good sense of, am I a likely target? And also to be able to do that is understanding really who you are. If you don't really know who you are, what you offer, how you relate to things around you or adjacent to, you know, like targets or interested targets, that's part of the exercise. But, you know, for this instance, yeah, maybe nation state wouldn't be worried about a brewery, but obviously cybercrime would, right? There's money, easy money to be made, you know, especially if there's something that's production related where it's something that runs 24/7 or runs all the time. Anytime you can stop something like that, there's potential for, you know, urgency for them to like recover. So there's more need to potentially pay quicker than trying to solve the problem that they create. So, you know, that I thought was something that was interesting to me as I was thinking through this. But also, you know, there wasn't a lot of detail here for what they did, but it's always interesting, you know, when people do these exercises for how is my business going to recover if I was hit with the same thing? I think sometimes when you look at a more simplified version of attack, like being taken down by ransomware at a brewery might not be as impactful for a business model where their entire business is online, right? Where losing certain data or intellectual property there may it be more risk or, you know, more impactful than say a brewery would because they're really just making beer, running lines and filling things and just trying to get things out the door and sell. There might be some recipes, right, that could be intellectual property. But usually you need the right types of ingredients and yeast only because, you know, I know I've got a lineage of brewing in my background. So they might not be as easy to replicate necessarily either. But you might be able to learn from simpler attacks for like what worked and what didn't to try to maybe considering your approaches, like how to contain, maintain things to worry about, because they had the right amount of supplies to carry them through shutdown. So it didn't really affect their business that much. Now, will it affect their business somewhat? Yeah, I'm sure there's going to be some effect, but it seemed like they were prepared for this and they're not a huge technical company, right? They're not a company that deals with cyber and deals with all sorts of technology and cloud and everything else. And they were able to have all the right things in the right place where they're like, yeah, we were hit, took things down. We're still good. We can still provide everything. Our business is okay. And that's where I think a lot of companies need to be. They need to have that kind of confidence and that kind of process to say, this is how we plan to recover. And we know what to do when this happens. So I think that was a good kind of lesson to learn from this that would be a good takeaway for a lot of people.
Would you call it a masterclass in ransomware response?
I would hate to call anything that, but sometimes the simple response is an easier or best response. You know, sometimes if you look at some response plans, it's like super detailed, which is good to have because it means you're thinking through everything. But like, you know, their solution was, yeah, we'd shut things down. You know, and then, you know, then catch your breath and figure out what are the key pieces we need to start restoring, you know, that kind of approach. But yeah, I don't know.
It was a good one either way.
Yeah, it was kind of fun. A little different.
Yeah, it was. No doom and gloom here. Just don't worry, there's extra beer. All right, how are you going to do this one?
Yeah, I mean, this one might not be too interesting, but there's some things that I thought that were interesting about it. And I actually just kind of came across them from the Info Security magazine. So there's not a lot of technical details, but I'm going to kind of assume some things that I've mentioned. But it's called Dropbox used to steal credentials and bypass MFA in novel phishing campaign. So the thing that I thought was really interesting was apparently there was a phishing campaign where a PDF file was basically shared, but not in a traditional emails attachment. It looked like, and I'm assuming this is how this was shared because they didn't really describe this, but basically, I'm assuming there was a malicious file on someone's Dropbox account and they shared it from Dropbox. So the Dropbox sent a message on their behalf to say, hey, a file has been shared with you, kind of approach, because the recipients of this email was from the no reply at Dropbox.com, a legitimate email address that basically Dropbox uses for notifications. But in doing this, that means that kind of phishing email will not be blocked, right? Because it's technically legitimate. There's no real reason to question it, but it basically gives you the link that takes you to the PDF that's being hosted by Dropbox if they have the accessibility, where they can open the PDF file, they can go to a suspicious link, which takes them to what looks like a Microsoft Office 360 or Microsoft 365 login for stealing credentials. So I thought that was really interesting. And not only that, but apparently if you fail to receive the or click on the link for the file that was shared, I don't know if it was just built in automatically in Dropbox or the adversary had to go say, hey, reshare this. But a reminder email came to say, hey, you know, this was shared with you. You know, maybe they noticed you didn't try to access it kind of thing. And so I thought that was really interesting way to trick people into clicking on something because it bypasses a lot of security controls to take you certain places. And one of the other things that's really hard for security tools to prevent are just sites that steal your credentials that you're willing to put into them. Because it's not like it's malicious as far as malicious code. It's just a login and it can't differentiate if it's a valid login or not because it doesn't interpret pictures and pages the way we do in your security tools. So anyways, that was the novel approach that kind of kicked this whole thing off. The other thing that I didn't quite understand is they didn't really explain it, but they basically were saying that attackers were successfully able to bypass MFA. So there's a couple ways where this potentially could happen. Someone tries to log in, they have something set up on the page where it will then redirect. So you can do like a man in the middle of MFA. So they feel like they're actually logging into the right thing and the user's actually doing the MFA for them. Or if MFA isn't set up in a certain way, maybe there's can be resets to the MFA that they can now leverage with credentials. So now they have control of the MFA as the attacker. Or if they have access to change the policies altogether, then they're able to also get around that. They didn't describe how that was done. But one of the things they were able to see though was after this phishing attack occurred, there's subsequent unusual logins, as they put it. They were associated with ExpressVPN, which is just a VPN service you can pay for that kind of masks where you really are. And then they later used another VPN service. God, I forgot what it was. If I come across it, I'll bring it up. Oh, hi, yeah. The Hide My Ass VPN service. That's right. That's why I couldn't remember it because it's so
Nice.
weird. But yeah, so it was interesting. They're using, you know, publicly available VPN services to kind of mask their stuff because, you know, as a for companies, that's something that you can get the IP space for these publicly available VPN services to hide stuff, and you can block those outright just to make it harder for other people to use those things. Because there's no reason why your employees would need to mask themselves before connecting in anyways. But that's something that adversaries will use. And one of the good things about using these types of services is you can appear from the country you're supposed to be in as your target, you know, so it doesn't throw those out of bound. alerts, for instance, like, hey, impossible travel, or you're logging in from Vietnam, but you're a US-based company and you always log in from the US, you can skirt some of that by using these services. So that might be one of the reasons why they use them, not just to hide themselves. But they were able to see the unusual logins there. So that was something that was easily identified. But something else that was interesting and something good to take note of is once the threat actors kind of got access to at least some of the email and things, they set up some rules in the email, which basically redirected certain emails and to the conversation history mailbox folder, which is one that a lot of people don't look at. But making rules in general in mailboxes isn't common for a lot of users, and it's not something that happens frequently. So even if you have users that are really savvy with their email, and they want to create these rules to help them manage, that's great, but they probably aren't doing that every day. So it's something worth looking at, because I think there's logs for this in Office 365, where you can see when new email rules are created and then look at what does the rule actually do. And if the rule makes sense, you know, sometimes it's pretty obvious to say, oh, you know, yeah, they're auto-deleting these types of things because of whatever. But you can actually, you know, analyze the rule, and a human can just discern what looks suspicious or not from that case. So those are good things to look at for these types of attacks, or any kind of attack that takes, you know, account takeover or email compromise. But yeah, so that those were like the notes I kind of pulled from this. Like I said, there wasn't a lot of technical detail per se, so I kind of injected some of the things of how I think they would have occurred. But I did that because I linked from past experience, there have been legitimate ways this type of stuff has happened, and they're good things to be thinking about on these type of attacks. So, you know, sometimes it's like a good exercise for me to be seeing articles like this that aren't super technical and kind of, you know, spoon feed you what it is to go through. Okay, I've seen things like this. How could this be possible? And I might miss some things, but it kind of drills me on like, how well do I understand this problem and the possible solutions that I would apply as a security practitioner? So, yeah. Well, what were your thoughts?
Well, I think you said them all. I was blown away by the MFA fatigue again, where they're just probably taking that for taking advantage of the lack of patience that normal humans have for technology. Thinking about like if how many times you're trying to sign into something or you reset your password, and it's like, here's an alert, here's a notification, here's the numbers. So, you know, finally you're just like, God, okay, yes, like move on, like let me get into it. So if you are actively working and you see that coming, you probably think it's just like another thing, you know, just another moment where they're just, the tools are beating you up. Unfortunately, that's the reality we have, and that's the reality that adversaries are taking advantage of. And the other mention I was going to, or call out, was the rule that they created. That was crazy, that once they gained access to your environment, instead of like, using all like persistence or deleting a bunch of emails, they just moved them to the side of something that people don't really look into, and so they could constantly look back and see what's going on. You know, if they need something to reuse, like they have their own little email box there, so if they need to access something, they can. I thought that was wild, but yeah, you pretty much covered it all. It was a wild, interesting article. And a very interesting technique. So I guess if you check your rules, see if there's ever a new one created, beware.
Yeah, so with that, we got a couple things I want to bring up. The first thing is we have an upcoming workshop this month on the 20th, so 9 days away. And it's hunting for initial access, and it's actually led by Lee. And that's March 20th, 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I don't know if you want to have anything to say to that, Lee.
Yeah, so if you're ever looking to get hands-on threat hunting experience with a sim and a set of data, what we like to do is we like to set the stage of what MITRE tactic we'll be looking at. This time it's initial access. And there's very little depth by PowerPoint, but just enough to provide you enough information on what's going on. from there, what we're going to do is we're going to take some two community edition hunt packages from the Hunter platform that you can access simply by registering and signing up for a community account. And then we're going to use those to start our hunt in the data set that we have, which as a registered student, you'll get an OBA, which has, it's a virtual box that has Kibana running on it or Elastic running on it. So you'll be able to use a free version of that. You'll get the data and you'll get the documents that we provide as well so that you can follow along during the class as we pivot through the data. So once we find results from the initial query, where do we go from there? How do we find interesting artifacts and so on? There's always going to be a challenge at the end so that you can actually put the skills that you've learned to the test and find our flag that is in the data, report that, and you'll get a nice badge for completing the project.
Nice. And the next thing I want to mention is we will have our live edition of this podcast where we interact with our listeners via Discord. And that'll be April 4th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And the only thing I ask is if you listen to this podcast and there's topics, either technical, professional, whatever they are that you'd be interested in, reach out to any one of us, but you can definitely message me on LinkedIn. And I'll try to include those, to have talking points. I will probably put a post out on LinkedIn for people to reach out as well as a reminder, the kind of prompt, because we really like to engage with people and address some of their concerns or some of the hot topics they just really like to talk about. So we have that going on, which should be a good time. So with that, just want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And with that, that closes out our top five threat hunting headlines for the week of March 11th, 2024.
Happy hunting, everyone.
Happy hunting.
Thanks for listening to the Out of the Woods podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode. For more information or to connect with Cyborg Security, check us out online at www.cyborgsecurity.com and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time.